Etymologically, the term conspiracy comes from Latin con, with, together, and spirare, to breathe. Metaphorically, it is breathing together, conspiring, as if becoming united in one breath, one goal in unison, like trumpets conspire in a symphony or voices in a choir. This is the image I would like to begin with in the context of raising the question of how we might imagine a conspiracy of peace today in speaking from different languages and institutions, cultural, political, diplomatic, academic, that is to say, from different breaths, different instruments, and different voices. On one level, while this involves the question of translation, as I will talk about, and also Emily will talk about later on tonight as well, this also involves what I will talk about as the reality of censorship, the current regimes of censorship today in comparison with Kant's time. However, before getting to the conspiracy of peace proper, let us turn again to the opening of Kant's essay on perpetual peace to read the secret meaning of the satirical inscription on the Dutch innkeeper's sign. Quote, "Whether the satirical inscription on the Dutch innkeeper's sign upon which the burial ground was painted had for its object mankind in general, or the rulers of states in particular who are insatiable of war, or merely philosophers who dream this sweet dream, it is not for us to decide, but one condition the author of this essay wishes to lay down. The practical politician assumes the attitude of looking down with great satisfaction on the political theorist as a pedant whose empty ideas in no way threaten the security of the state. Inasmuch as the state must proceed on empirical principles, so the theorist is allowed to play his game without interference from a worldly wise statesman. Such being his attitude, the practical politician, and this is the condition I make, should at least consistently in the case of a conflict and not suspect some danger to the state in the political theorist's opinions, which are ventured and publicly expressed without any ulterior purpose. This is my clausula salvatoria. The author desires formally and emphatically to depreciate herewith any malevolent interpretation which might be placed on his words." Unquote. The satirical inscription could have three possible meanings. For humankind in general, in view of the conflict that surrounds us on a daily basis, it could be the sad resignation that the state of peace belongs only to the graveyard. For the rulers of the state, who are insatiable for war and violence, it could serve as a reminder that all their dreams of power will come to nothing and they build their houses on sand. For the philosophers who dream the sweet dream of peace, whose ideas are empty and who have a better chance of understanding death than having any knowledge of perpetual peace, this could be their caution as well. Concerning which meaning was meant by the innkeeper who hung the sign as a kind of grotesque joke, Kant says, does not concern us. What seems to concern us, however, at this moment, is that his words not be taken all that seriously. The worldly wise statesman, he says, should not read into the publication of perpetual peace some hidden intention or some malevolent design against the state or against the opinion of the practical politician. Being only a theoretical expression of peace, the philosopher's words are harmless, his ideas are empty, his opinions are like a game played by pedants and fools. The worldly politician who looks down from above, from the position of an adult who knows well the realities of war and of peace, the permanence of death and violence, views the philosopher's activity as that of a child playing with ideas in which he or she knows nothing about. Nevertheless, Kant seems to accept this derogatory situation and even states it as a condition which he calls his safety clause, that everything that he is about to say should have the appearance of a game, should not be taken the least bit seriously, except only in the sense that it be understood as a purely theoretical and not understood as an opinion published to persuade the public in the matter of politics or morality, that war is actually evil, for example, rather than a sad necessity, or that rulers and practical politicians conspire together as if in the same breath when they lie to the people that they really want peace, even while they are preparing for the next war. Of course, Kant does not say this exactly, or does he? And this will be the question that we ask. By inventing a game called perpetual peace, a game that has rules and even takes the form of a peace treaty. Just for pretend, since the terms of this treaty are not binding, and the practical politicians and the rulers are neither parties nor signatories to this truce. Since to them it is simply a child's game played by philosophers. So if you want to play the game of perpetual peace, you have to get down on the floor, on the blue carpet, like children, and learn to play along. But before starting the game, that is, before going over the rules on the inside of the box, I want to stop for a moment and ask the following question. How did the idea of peace become a game in the first place? Or worse, the object of a kind of gallows humor, as in the satirical sign above the Dutch Inn? This is the true intention of Kant's use of this anecdote to begin his essay, to underline the fact that according to the historical conditions of sensibility that regulate the degrees to which ideas or concepts correspond to reality, the concept of peace either appears de facto like a silly fantasy, a childlike dream, or worse, like a cruel and sadistic joke in light of all the world's violence and war. This, I believe, was Kant's entire point. It should, first of all, strike the reader as odd that the term peace should immediately have these associations, that of fantasy, that of being an empty idea, or that of being a joke or a satirical inscription, but rather addresses the limitations of our manner of understanding the idea, that is, our cognition, our imagination, our practical knowledge concerning what the idea represents, but most importantly, according to Kant's earlier critique of pure reason, our own desire for the idea's reality in the first place. For example, if peace was merely an unreal idea like pink elephants or unicorns, the ideas of a child's fantasy, like the land in which all the people are happy or live in the bark of some elfin wood, then the idea would simply appear light and innocent and would have no other quality than simply an object of fantasy. And this would make it pleasant to consider and even to imagine, as long as the idea remains in an imaginary space reserved for unrealistic ideas, which is why in so-called civilized society, it is often assigned to the mental life of children, where such ideas can take place without harming our sense of reality, and even adults can enjoy the most childish ideas from a distance of adulthood while maintaining a firm grasp on the world. And that is, according to exactly the same scenario that Kant begins with the adult politician looking down on the philosopher who plays the game of peace on the floor. This is actually a literal translation of the German. But the fact that peace is simply unreal does not completely account for the derogatory appearance of the idea given by the satirical image of the Dutch Inn. Unreal objects or ideas simply by virtue of being unreal are not necessarily objects of humor or satire. Pink elephants are not satirical. They are simply unreal. The image on the sign above the inn, however, which associates the idea of perpetual peace with death, while not necessarily funny, is definitely satirical and ironic. The joke runs, "While we cannot guarantee our tired and weary sojourner, the stranger to our land, any hope of perpetual peace, which can only be reserved for the grave, we can at least reserve him a temporal lodging for the night and perhaps a good night's sleep." Now, objects of satire usually designate special kinds of objects. Most satire are usually objects of social derision, mockery, and ideas that are said to be beneath us, including ideas that the civilized adult wouldn't want to be associated with as the idea that he believes in enough to invest with reality. The idea of peace is among these ideas. The satire is a technique one usually uses to take distance from the idea, to make a mockery of it. So I'm playing with the idea that, in a sense, in even today, in most common discourse, when the concept of the idea of peace comes up, there's an immediate censorship or an immediate repression of the idea's appearance or its reality, that it's impossible, it's impractical, it's a fantasy, or it's not a reality. So in a sense, this is what I'm probing in relation to Kant's essay, to ask, in a sense, where does that effect, where does that appearance first come from to begin with? As I said, at the basis of certain unreal ideas that are merely assigned to the world of children, but derisory ideas, in this case, the idea of peace, is assigned to philosophy. I ask again, shouldn't it strike us as odd that the idea of peace should be, if not obscene, at least the object of satire, or what amounts here to a bad joke? In the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant himself had already classified certain unreal ideas as ideas of reason. These are soul, the world, and God. But unreal means here that they cannot be empirically proven, but are essentially regulative or theoretical, since it is by means of these ideas that we aspire towards a final knowledge that is already presupposed in practice. In each of these cases, Kant claims, the idea allows us to represent problematically the systematic unity towards which we aspire and which we presuppose in empirical studies or in practice. Again, unreal here is taken in a special sense of having a purely theoretical appearance. The soul cannot be empirically proven. The world cannot be viewed in one glance. Accordance with the idea of God, according to Kant, we consider every connection in the world according to the principles that it had been conceived. What is the idea of peace, if not a subspecies, for Kant, of the idea of God, which in Kant's system stands for community? That is, the total connection or the finality of the notion of community. In the Kantian system, the idea of peace, and perpetual peace in particular, is a purely theoretical idea of unity or harmony that is presupposed as the guiding principle of what he calls universal cosmopolitanism. But it is also, and I'll talk about this, it is an idea that is also presupposed at the basis of every actual instance of peace conducted by the practical philosopher. In order for the philosopher to justify the end of that goal, he has to presuppose, or she has to presuppose, the finality that goes beyond just the end of this war or the end of this conflict. That is, the end of all conflict is always a horizon, even though it can never be empirically proven or practically grasped as an object. Okay, I apologize. That's the kind of like philosophical part of this thing. I'll get to the sexy, you know, kind of contemporary moment in a minute. At the beginning of Perpetual Peace, Kant assumes that this is a fact, an expression of a historical condition of peace, that the idea of peace as a theoretical idea is a contradiction to the rights of nations and to the ruling interests that make up current international law. And this was true at Kant's time in the 18th century, and it is still true to a great deal today. In other words, the reason why the idea of peace appears as theoretical or impractical is because it would directly violate or contradict the notion of right, the right of nation, the right of law, the rule of law, as well as international law. But there is a stronger power that characterized what could be called the publicity of peace, causing it to appear, first of all, as an empty idea, which is the pure idea of peace is actually an object of censorship in the public sphere. Now, censorship doesn't always function to suppress or repress. In fact, it rarely functions in this way, or when it does overtly function as repression, it always fails eventually. But rather, censorship functions to fundamentally distort or disfigure the degree of reality that belongs to an idea. In fact, under a regime of censorship, we might go on talking about peace all day and all night. We can organize rallies for peace as well as exhibits, as long as the degree of reality that pertains to the appearance of the idea remains purely virtual, theoretical, and innocuous. However, the minute that the idea tips over into practical action and serves as the guiding principle of community, it is quickly found to violate some pre-established arrangement between powerful private and public interests to become then an object of censorship, if it is not already, as I have been arguing, concerning the public idea of public peace, censored in advance, already dissimulated or distorted, rendered innocuous and unreal. What happened when the public nature of an idea that serves as the guiding and regulative principle becomes practical and no longer merely theoretical, cultural, artistic, or philosophical? That is to say, when its nature becomes overtly political. According to Kant, most political interests are termed private, which is why they take place in secret and outside the public sphere. This also applies to the idea of peace. For the idea of peace to appear in the public sphere, it must first be censored by all the forms of private political interest. For example, if the idea of peace is a purely theoretical idea that is presupposed in all political practice of diplomacy as a guiding rule for practical knowledge. However, the practical idea of diplomacy in Kant's time, as well as in our own, the idea of peace is often a deception in Kant's, since it is employed strategically to gain some interest or to enforce some right, or in Kant's word, Kant's words, to prepare some for some future conflict. The real aims of diplomacy are often secret and are not revealed before the public without deception or censorship, diversion of the real private political ends, as the recent revelations of the WikiLeaks vividly demonstrates. The WikiLeaks reports, in the past few years, governments have designated so much information secret that the number of new secrets has risen almost 75%. At the same time, the number of documents and other communications created using those secrets has skyrocketed to 10 times what it was 2 years ago. The proportion to which governments conduct its principal business and its treaties in secret is equal to the degree that the government is defined by private political interests and represents a conspiracy against the public. In some ways, I would like to characterize Kant's Perpetual Peace as a kind of quaint 18th century version of the WikiLeaks. And this is why the fundamental notion of publicity underscores everything that is in the document. Kant's discussion that there can be no clause in a treaty that maintains secrecy because it would violate or contradict the notion of the treaty itself or a public treaty. He writes about, for instance, everything, the notion of publicity or the public use of reason should be fundamentally protected from all state secrets. And this becomes the basis of his discussion of international law and the basis for why he says that the current conditions of national right and of the rights of nations would contradict this notion of the public use of reason. He says the secret character of governments is a violation of the public reason. Finally, about the existence of censorship that informs the historical contradiction, that the idea of peace can only belong to the discourse of philosophy, where it is censored and rendered innocuous, if not untranslatable. So what I'm talking about is, in the secret article, Kant works out or strikes a compromise to say that because the degree to which states need to operate through secrecy and using secrets is becoming more and more an accepted part of state craft and state practice, then the very notion of peace cannot exist. In other words, there can be no final or theoretical or regulative concept of peace in this situation. If we are then to reduce our limits of our historical understanding of power and of peace or the finality of community to the current conditions of the nation state, then this would, in a sense, be the end of philosophy. So by rendering philosophy somewhat innocuous, allowing that peace would still exist in philosophy as long as the idea was rendered non-political, defamed, is Kant's way of striking a bargain or a compromise to allow the idea of a finality, to allow the idea of an end of community to continue to circulate in public discourse, even though it would not circulate in political discourse, except in the form of deception. Okay? So the WikiLeaks is, in a sense, in a very interesting way, I mean, and we can talk about this in brief, but it kind of is a vivid demonstration of, if we think about just today, there was an announcement that U.S. prosecutors are seeking ways to prosecute the WikiLeaks inventor or creator, Assange, as under the laws of conspiracy. So in a sense that U.S. conspiratorial laws, and this is very difficult, they're trying to find a law either through the release of state government secrets or the release that, since, you know, basically he cannot be enforced under certain laws or the law is too broad to enforce, they're trying to find a way to enforce that notion. However, what's becoming blatantly obvious is the notion that the fact that diplomacy operates through this secret, these secrets, continue and permeate the continuation of certain forms of interest of conflict and war. And as long as those secrets operate through those channels and are accepted or tolerated by the public, then we will always be in a situation of, in a sense, inflaming war and using war to the advantage of capital, of NGOs, of other partnerships and forms of interest that combine with the state today. So in a sense, the real threat, so the response to the WikiLeaks is actually a real interesting kind of test case to some of the issues that, in a sense, Kant raises about the perpetual peace. Now, I'll just end with, I won't read there's a longer essay version of this on the Perpetual Peace website. But I think that it's that this occasion is not really more of an academic occasion. I just end with a little bit of just a history about Kant's essay, because I think it's important to understand the context. Why did Kant, I mean, there's two things to question. Why did Kant, one, publish this in 1795 in the form of a peace treaty? A peace treaty that he, as a philosopher, knew that it had no validity. It had no legal standing. It was a simulacra in some ways. It was a performance. It was a way of circulating ideas in that form, but in a sense stating the sense and the meaning of those ideas in the framework of finality, that is, of perpetual peace. If you want perpetual peace, here's what you need to do. No more standing armies, to completely abolish colonialism, because no state can be possessed by another, to not use forms of war that would lead to generations later on having hostilities towards the, you know, to inflame conflicts that would last intergenerationally. And that is one of the most profound kind of statements that Kant makes, because he talks about the fact that in war or in conflict, if you use a means that will, in a sense, impact a culture's later generations, then it will inflame a conflict to last perpetually. In other words, one generation will constantly pass down. So we've seen conflicts concerning Greece and Albania, or Muslim and Catholic populations in Croatia, as well as in Herzegovina, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and other places, that in a sense are vivid testimonies to, as well as the testimony of what occurs in 20th century Europe in anti-Semitism and the realization of that intergenerational or inter-transgenerational conflict. So in a certain way, Kant lays out these in the form of peace treaty. The one thing that we need to remember is that it was a parody or a response to an actual peace treaty that occurred in 1795 called the Peace of Basel. And that was a treaty between the Austrians, the Spanish, and the French that ended the First Napoleonic War, that is, the end of the First Coalition. In that treaty, however, it reserved the conditions for future wars against Napoleon's army that occurred later on, including the fact that the English refused to participate in this. Austria sued for peace because of debt. It could not continue the war, and therefore it was a suing for peace because they ran out of money and they couldn't continue the war. The treaty allowed them to build and to rebuild and restructure the army, as well as the English to use forms of assassins and poisoners and other forms of techniques to try to overflow or to oppose. So, I mean, Kant is responding to that particular situation. Now, the comparison to WikiLeaks is, again, Kant's form of publicity was very antique. He was trying to play with the state censors in Germany and Austria to allow his document to come out. So this parody and the notion of defeating and even an irony becomes a part of that structure, which is an 18th century structure. Today, with the internet and the power of publicity, more direct and different means of publicity are available. And therefore, irony is a kind of outdated and literary form in some ways, too, and maybe philosophy as well. And that's what I would say in some ways, that's why philosophy today seems like an antique and somewhat antiquated discourse when you're talking about 20th century issues. But in a sense, the framework is there for us to understand the vivid realities of the revelation of these cables that occurred, as well as the function of secrecy and the public use of reason is, in a sense, at the basis of still a conflict that, in a sense, begins in Kant's time and, in a sense, is perpetuated in our own time. So I'll end there so that we can have questions and then move on to the next speaker. Thank you.